To order. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 189.
House Bill 189, introduced by Representative Stubson, an act relating to real property, foreclosure, and redemption revisions. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Barbuto, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation that House Bill Number 189 do pass, and I also move the Standing Committee Amendment, and I would turn the explanation of both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment over to the sponsor.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would go ahead and urge the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. It's really primarily clarifying language. If there's any questions, I'd take them. Otherwise, I'd ask for the question on the Standing Committee.
Okay, question having been called on the Standing Committee Amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After this body's actions right before lunch, it's with much trepidation that I appear before you again, but I think we have a winner. The bill before you deals with the foreclosure process in the state of Wyoming, and it really handles four different areas of that process. And it's designed to give more tools to both lenders and borrowers in dealing with foreclosure situations, as well as clarifying a number of the ambiguities that currently exist in the law. And just by way of a quick background on the procedure for foreclosure in Wyoming, typically the process is you send a notice of intent to the person that's being foreclosed on, then the foreclosing party has to publish for four consecutive weeks in a newspaper, and then there's a public sale held on the courthouse steps. And typically, in many cases, the bank or the lending party will be the successful bidder at that sale. Sometimes, however, you'll find a third party that will come in and bid at that sale. The first part of this bill, which is Section 118, well, let me back up. One more point before we jump into it. Following that foreclosure sale, there's a period of redemption, which in most properties it's 90 days. With respect to agricultural properties, it's a year. And during that period of redemption, the defaulting debtor gets to hold on to the property. The party that's foreclosed bought at the sheriff's sale doesn't get to go in and take control of the property. The debtor remains in control of the property until that time expires. And any time during that 90 days, they can come back. And if they have enough money, if they have the price that was bid in at the sheriff's sale plus 10%, they can bring that forward, and they get the sheriff's deed to the property, and the mortgage is taken care of, and that's the end of the process. The problem arises, or a problem arises, in that after the fact, currently under Wyoming law, there's nothing after that foreclosure sale takes place that would allow a borrower and a debtor to do some sort of workout other than the full payment of what's due and owing plus 10%. And so, for example, and this bill really comes out of a conversation I had when I was walking neighborhoods during the campaign and talking to a guy whose daughter was going through a foreclosure, and she was about 30 days away from getting a settlement in a workers' comp case, but her foreclosure sale was about a week away. And so you can't, unless you have the full amount to redeem, you're out of luck. What this does is it creates a process called rescission. And that is basically a setting aside of the foreclosure sale if the foreclosing party agrees to do that. And there's really three circumstances, and if you look on pages 2 and 3, there's three circumstances under which rescission can occur. If the purchaser at the foreclosure sale is the lending party, is the bank, then they can rescind. If they decide to rescind, they can rescind. So in this circumstance I talked about, you can have that young lady come in and say, hey, I can't give you everything you bid in. I can't afford a redemption, but what I can do is catch the loan up, maybe even give you a couple $1,000 extra if you would just set aside the foreclosure sale. They can reach an agreement to do that, and then they can just rescind the foreclosure sale, and it's like it never occurred, and they're back in the position they were before that foreclosure sale. So it's really a tool and an opportunity for debtors and lenders to work together to keep people in their houses. Bankers don't like getting possession of these properties and having to liquidate them, and this gives them a tool to avoid that in circumstances when they're able to agree to those sorts of arrangements. The second one in Section C is a circumstance when a third party comes in and bids. So the bank isn't the successful bidder. Instead, a third party comes in and bids. And in that case, the rescission can only occur if the purchasing party at the foreclosure sale agrees to it. So they have to agree to take either what they bid in back, or some other arrangement. But they have to agree to the rescission. And then finally, under D, there's a ability for a foreclosing party to rescind the sale under all circumstances if the sale was invalid for some reason. And where this comes up quite often is you'll see a bankruptcy filing maybe the morning of the foreclosure sale. Somebody may file bankruptcy at 9 a.m. and the foreclosure sale's at 10. Under our law, that foreclosure sale's void. But if you don't have notice, they go through and they issue the certificate of sale and everything. This would allow a rescission to be done in those sort of circumstances when the sale was void in the first place. So that is the first section of the bill, 118, 115. And then Section E spells out what happens when the certificate of rescission is filed. And like I say, it's just resetting the clock, acting like the foreclosure sale never occurred. Now, the other matters, 118, 104 on page 4, this talks about the redemption period. And as I said, redemption is when you pay what was bid in at the foreclosure sale plus 10%. Currently, under Wyoming law, there's no ability to do a short sale during that redemption period. So if the borrower comes back and says, I can't quite give you everything you bid in plus the 10%, I can give you 95% of what you bid in. Maybe a bank wants to do that, but there's no ability under the law for them to accept that sort of deal. So again, the language that we've added here gives more ability for the lenders and the borrowers to bargain back and forth during that redemption period and hopefully keep a borrower in their house. Section E on page 5, this clears up an ambiguity that I was reading a book that was written back in, I think, the early 70s that pointed out that this was an area of confusion and needed to be clarified. So I decided maybe it's time we should clarify it. And what happens is, like I said, agricultural property has a 12-month redemption period, but it's unclear, the way the law is written, it would insinuate that you could get on that property after just the 3 months that applies to ordinary property. So what this does is it clarifies, that debtor remains in possession of the property throughout the 12 months. And courts have gone back and forth and found both ways on this, but this provides clarification. And remember, if a lender needs to get onto that property, they still have the ability to do so through a receivership or something like that. And then finally, a clarification in 344107, the separate sale of tracts. I can answer questions on this, but in kind of a thumbnail sketch is there's real confusion. If you have a piece of property that's broken up into multiple lots, the law right now requires you to sell each one individually, and then if you don't get the full amount that you're due and owing, then you shall sell the whole amount. And even maybe you sell the whole amount and you get even less. Our statute doesn't give you the option of selling just individual parcels instead of the whole amount. So this just simply says the foreclosing party can elect whether they want to sell specific lots that are securing that mortgage or the entire property. So with that, it was a really quick run through, but I'd take any questions you may have on the bill.
Is there any discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 189 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill number 189 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 179. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 179, introduced by Representative Petroff, an act relating to local improvements, energy improvement program. This bill was sent to the committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson, no. Croker, signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 179 do pass, and the representative from House District 16 will explain the bill.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I bring to you House Bill 179, Energy Improvements. As a way of background, we all know that our energy bills are rising, but it's not just the cost of the resource that's rising. One of the major factors in energy increases is the cost is increased energy use, so the capital costs involved in generating and transmitting new energy. And that's why all of our utility companies offer incentives for energy-efficient appliances, and why they offer free energy audits, and all kinds of things to get us to use less energy, because it saves them money if we can stay within the energy use that we currently have, and it saves us money as consumers. I should tell you, there's a handout on your desk, a one-page. The cost of building a new power plant has doubled in the last 10 years. The national average energy cost is 11.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Our Wyoming average is only 8.3 cents, and that's partially because our energy use hasn't grown at the same pace that the national average is. So on the bill, on page 1, line 12, 15.1701, this section refers to industrial development projects. And moving on to page 2, it defines some of those projects, and the addition here is on line 9 and 10 that the project may also mean energy improvements program. Line 12 through 15 defines the energy improvements program as a program authorizing energy efficiency or renewable energy improvements in a program adopted by a municipality, county, or multi-county joint powers board. Again, on line 21, it adds energy improvements. And then the crux of what this all means is on page 3, lines 4 and 5, where it says, all of which are hereby declared to be and constitute public purposes. Right now, counties, municipalities, and joint powers boards cannot participate in residential energy improvement programs because of the constitutional provision that we can't benefit for a private purpose. So what this does is this acknowledges that there is a public benefit to energy improvements. So that's the first part of the bill, and that's the part that's most important to my community. My community is the way this would affect my community, and the program that we are currently working on is a partnership between our rural electric co-op, the county, and the town. And what we're doing is the utility provider will offer free home energy audits and then low-interest loans to make the improvements. A local bank has offered to process the loans for the utility at actually below their process cost. They're doing this because they're involved in the community and they care about all the benefits that it'll bring, but because of the economic climate, they're not able to make these loans the way that they used to be able to. The utility will have a secured interest in the property, and then they'll bill the loan payment on the utility bill. Because of negative cost investment of these improvements, most people will have a lower overall payment. So that means that the improvements enacted will begin immediately saving them money. Their reduced energy bill, combined with their loan cost on that energy bill, will likely have a lower net income. Now, a lower net payment. The way that the town and county would like to participate would be to put up a small fund for the loan defaults. The rate of default on these types of loans is less than 1%, so it's a pretty minimal involvement in the part of our community. But what the second half of the bill does is for other communities that might want to enact a program like this in a different way, it allows them to treat it the way they would a special improvements district, where they can actually manage loans for their residents and then have the loan repayment through the property tax assessment. One thing that I failed to mention in the beginning, the energy improvements plays a role in all of our communities throughout the state and throughout the nation. The way it plays out in our community is our power company has capped power sales to all of its customers. Our utility was capped at 85 megawatts in October of 2010. Our rural electric co-op currently pays a base amount of 3 cents per kilowatt hour. So every time we go above the 85 megawatts, we'll be paying between 2 and 5 times that amount. So all of our citizens will be paying between 6 and 15 cents for any additional power that they use. It's equalized, so everybody pays this additional cost, and it's projected to cost our county $135 million more in energy over the next 20 years. So I think there can be a little argument that there is a public benefit to saving energy, which is the first part of the bill, and I'll let you debate the second part, whether or not you're interested in allowing municipalities to enter into that kind of loan program, but I'll stand for any questions at this time.
Is there any discussion on the bill? Question having been called, Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And right off the reel, I think this is a very, very good idea. But I had a couple of questions just because of what I don't know about the background on this specific bill. Were you in touch with other entities that provide service, electric service around the state as an example? We have a different utility here in Cheyenne and a different one for most of the state and some up in the northern part. Were those utilities contacted at all on this suggested legislation?
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess I'd like to have an enumeration of what parties end up paying this. I know you touched on consumers and the $135 million, but what about property owners and the costs of this? You know, a loan is still a loan. You got to pay back a low interest loan or a attractive loan, just like another one. Do the powers of the municipalities include the power to force someone into this that happens to be located there and that kind of thing? I'm just kind of looking at it from the private property rights vantage point, I guess.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did have testimony at the committee hearing from lobbyists representing those industries who testified that they saw nothing negative in the bill, and they're certainly in favor of anything that can be done for energy improvements. And I if that's not accurate, if anybody in the committee would correct me, that would be helpful. And then to answer the other question, currently, 25 states have enacted this type of system in the last 2 years precisely because banks are unable to make these kinds of loans. The second part of the program is entirely voluntary. It would be up to the individual homeowner to enter into a specific agreement. They would be under the same restraints that they are under the current special improvements district. It would just give greater flexibility to the municipalities and counties to be able to use this tool to the benefit of their citizens. And if I didn't answer your question, please let me know.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you. I'm just wondering where the cities, counties, and boards are going to get the money to loan? Are they going to come to the state and want to get money to so they can do this, or just how is this part of it going to work?
Chairman Lockhart? No. Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This works just like all the other industrial revenue bonds. You have, in particular in the county that has all the gas over on the western side of the state, they routinely there are companies that are drilling that will actually get the county to issue industrial revenue bonds. Industrial revenue bonds are, they're supposed to do two things. One is to improve your economic well-being by providing funds to build factories or other industrial type things. So the county issues the bond, or it could be a municipality too. They issue the bond, the money goes to that entity that is going to build a factory or whatever, and they pay it back. The advantage is that tax-free bonds are issued. The other apparatus that's in that statute is healthcare facilities. So occasionally you'll see a healthcare facility using that same statute to I just recently saw a community counseling center issued industrial revenue bonds through a county in order to build a new facility. So the statute's already used like that. What they're doing here is adding in energy improvement program. So a bond would be issued by a bonding company on behalf of the county or municipality. It could be either one. And then how you pay back the bonds is, and this is on the third page you see there, it's an assessment on the property, so it runs with the land, not with the individual. Make sure that's understood. If you're doing it through a utility bill, that runs with the person. They're paying back through a utility bill. If you're paying back through your property bill, your property tax bill, it runs with the land. And so that's how they pay back the loan, they pay back the bonds. And then over time, they issue more bonds to have more money available to loan it out. There's quite a few states that have utilized this, and it's a way for counties to issue this, you know, come up with these funds through bonding, and then get paid back. You're guaranteed your payment back because it shows up either A, you can do it through a utility bill, it just adds on to their utility bill, or B, on their property tax bill. And you don't have to, even though they establish the area, which will be, and you'll see that on page 3, line 14, that they'll designate an energy improvement area. If they designate your area as energy improvement, you don't have to participate. It's only if you want to participate. So it's not like occasionally you see like ISDs and stuff where everyone in that designated district has to be a member. In this, you don't have to be a member. It's only if you wanted to. And what normally how they do this is you voluntarily agree to have an energy audit done of your home. They tell you what needs to be done of your home, either, you know, new windows to keep the, you know, energy in or, you know, whatever it is, new insulation. Then you decide whether or not you want to proceed. Now, you can just proceed on your own. You know, if you got the money in your bank account, you can just do it. Or if you don't have the money, you can obtain one of these loans to do it, and then you pay back the loan either A, through your utility bill, or B, through your property tax bill.
Further discussion? Chairman Lockhart?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is more of a comment than a question. This is working out very well in a lot of areas, and even utility companies are providing incentives to replace high energy use devices with lower energy uses and incentives in that and programs to pay it back. And I would just tell you this from a long experience in this area, that energy that you save is the best decision you can make. And if you're adding resources or you can conserve, conserve. And this is a good bill. I'd urge your support.
Further discussion? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 179 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill number 179 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 156.
The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 156, introduced by Representative Petroff, an act relating to state lands regarding Grand Teton National Park transfer of state lands. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources, which recommend that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Camel, Davison, Eklund, Hunt, Laux, Moniz, Zwanitzer, Dan. No, Semlek, sign. Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Semlek?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 156 do pass, and I turn the explanation of the bill over to the bill sponsor from House District 16.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You all have a thick packet of information about this bill in your box. I'll start by a little background information. All states admitted to the Union after 1803 received public lands to be used specifically for education. In our 1890 Act of Admissions, we received those lands, typically sections 16 and 36 of townships, to lease, exchange, or sell for the benefit of the common school trust account. In 1921, we created a Board of Land Commissioners to act as a legislative trust for those lands and those funds. In 1929, Grand Teton National Park was established, and in 1950, the boundaries of the park were extended to include several parcels of our school land. These parcels have become de facto part of the park. There's not a lot we can do with them. We lease them for about $2,000 a year for grazing one of the parcels. The other parcels, we don't have much use for. If you go to the second page on your packet, I believe, is the map of where these lands are located. There are three surface parcels and one mineral parcel, which is under Jackson Lake, 1,366 surface acres. And then if you go to the bill, what the bill does, it allows the land trust to transfer the lands to the Department of the Interior for the appraised value of the land. On line 10, the Board of Land Commissioners is authorized to convey all its right, title, and interest in the following described parcels of land within the boundaries of Grand Teton National Park to the United States Department of the Interior. So the first parcel is the mineral rights. Then this is the section that's under Jackson Lake. And forgive me for using proper names. I got permission ahead of time on this. The second parcel is the smaller of the three surface parcels. The third parcel, Antelope Flats, and all three of those are contained within the park. And then the fourth parcel, which we consider to be the most valuable because it actually has a border on the park edge. So it specifies that the proceeds will be deposited to the Common School Land Account within the Permanent Land Fund. You also have in your packet an agreement which was 32 years in the coming. As I was doing research on all of the work that went into this agreement, they started doing negotiations in 1978 to try to get the federal government to somehow compensate us for this land. The preference was to trade for land, and they tried for many years to accomplish this. The late U.S. Senator from Wyoming, who passed away 3.5 years ago, was very involved in this. From about 1998 until his passing. And even with all of his pull, we were unable to come up with an agreement that the school land trust felt was sufficient enough to properly meet our fiduciary responsibility as trust holders of that land. In the spring of this year, the then governor, out of frustration over the federal government's inaction, in dealing with us fairly, issued a press release saying that he was going to put the lands up for public auction. This created a stir nationally among conservationists and all kinds of people, and it forced the government into action. And that's where we land with this agreement. After a whole lot of work, a whole lot of time, a whole lot of effort, we finally have what we consider to be a fair compensation for these trust lands. The current appraisal on the trust lands is $107 million, and again, you have that packet. That would provide at the head person from the state treasurer's office testified at the hearing that at our current return rate, that would provide about $4.5 million a year to schools for operating costs as compared to the $2,000 a year that we're getting today. There was testimony as to how much effort went into the agreement. There was concern in the committee that the government owned too much land already, and I agree. But this is already essentially part of the park, and we're just looking for compensation for this land, and we've finally gotten to the point where we have an agreement. There was concern that we should deal with this on our terms, not theirs. And once again, I agree. But do we keep fighting for years out of principle, or do we take money for the schools and meet our fiduciary responsibility? And so with that, I'll stand for questions.
Chairman Semlick.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. In the fine explanation of the bill, the concerns that the good representative refers to, unfortunately, was probably only from one member of the committee, and that was probably me. And so I'd just like to offer perhaps a little bit different perspective. But first of all, I would tell you that I'm very mindful of the concern that the community in Northwest Wyoming has with respect to this issue, the concern that the property could be disposed of through public auction as it is constitutionally required for it to be, and the concern that it could be sold to the highest bidder to raise the greatest amount of funds for the fiduciary responsibility of the school land trust. But maybe that's not always the best use for that property. So I am mindful of that. So I frame my comments based around that concern. A couple issues with respect to the money that's involved. The comments in regard to the $2,000 or $3,000 that we received for a grazing lease on one of the properties and no income from the other, and then the possible sale of that property for $107 million, that money to be deposited in the school trust or the school foundation account, which will run our public schools in Wyoming for about 1 month. So the money, it, for me, is not the big issue. I just think that, and I heard the discussion in committee, I heard the discussion on the floor about the arduous process that we've been through all through the years of trying to negotiate some kind of a swap for land, and federal government doesn't want to play by rules. And I think we are in control of this issue, and I don't see any big reason to get in a hurry to go down this road to try to provide a legislative enactment to allow this to happen, and the uncertainty about whether or not it's ever going to happen because of the lack of really any affirmative commitment on the part of the Congress that they will appropriate the money for this project. Congress, through the actions for the last several years, you know, $13 trillion in debt. So I ask, where was Congress during the time when our national forest in Wyoming went into degradation because of poor management? What they told us was they did not have the money to appropriate for the EISs to provide oversight for timber sales. So as a result of that, the 13 sawmills that we once had are now down to one. Our forest health is in deplorable shape, and they just didn't have the money to appropriate. Where were they at the time, during that time, to provide the things that we really needed? Congress has treated Wyoming as a stepchild. This is just a, whether it's the issue of the wolves, whether it's issue of some of the lack of management they've had with our forest, whether it's the issue with our grazing land, we've always been stepped on and trodden on by the federal government. And now we have an opportunity to keep some leverage in this issue by using these properties, these 1,400 acres of property, to say, let's get serious about a land swap. We've got 62% of our land in Wyoming now that's in public control. I don't see where it would benefit us to continue to look at this. I think we ought to consider still keep our cards on the table, consider a mineral swap for coal lease minerals or for other land of equal value. And if we put these cards on the table and say we're done with this issue, then we've lost control of the debate. And I don't think we should do that. So I'm somewhat cautious about going down this road. Thank you, Madam
Chairman Childers.
Well, Madam Chairman, it's interesting that he brought up those points. I had some of the exact same points that I wanted to bring out, that for years on the wolf issue that we've been fighting, trying to get the right to manage them, try to prevent some of the problems we have, and they were introduced or reintroduced, however you want to take it, into the national park, spread out a little bit. I'm sure that everybody could say that. And as the good chairman of agriculture was talking about, you could also bring up the issue of the snowmobiles. And we come up with a EIS and make a decision on it. Make the final decision, the record of decision on it. And then the Department of Interior, the secretary says, no, I don't like that. You got to do it over. Now, I admit this and it has nothing to do with it. But what struck my attention with this bill right off is at the bottom of page one. All mineral rights owned by the state are going to be transferred. Think of the lands that we have in this state that are private surface and federal minerals and the influence that they have over the use of those lands and the use of the lands adjacent or even further away. That they own the mineral rights, so they direct how the project goes forward, even though it has a minor part as far as impacting them. Again, it bothers me that this doesn't have a lot to do with that, but we're transferring lands, and it took a number of years. It took the threat of the previous governor to go to a public auction so this could, number one, get a decent price out of it, number two, get them off dead center that they'd take care of it. I just almost stepped in the other room and got an amendment that we're going to keep the mineral rights. And if we keep the mineral rights, then we're going to have a little say-so in this national park when something goes on. But I probably won't do that because there's a lot of work that went into this. But I hope at some point that the federal government's going to start doing something that they listen to us. Sorry, I got on my soapbox. This bothers me.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to repeat anything that the fine chairman's just commented on. Those were some of my talking points also. But, you know, my position being down here and what my constituents sent me down here for was a federal control and, you know, maybe too much federal control on a lot of issues. And so my net position on an issue like this is no net gain of federal lands in Wyoming. And both speakers, previous speakers, hit on a point where I could accept this trade if they want to trade in some of their mineral rights that they control in the state of Wyoming and give them back to the state of Wyoming. Frankly, I don't want their $100 million. I'm not for sure what those greenbacks are going to be worth by the time we get them. And frankly, if this bill makes it to the second round, I think our national government has some gold in some place in some eastern state, and I think they value that gold at $50 an ounce. And so if they want to pay us in gold, I might just take that.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. On and against this bill for a number of reasons that have already been mentioned. We don't need to give more of our land to the federal government, especially in trade for something that's not worth as much as land, and that's money printed by the Federal Reserve. The more they print, the less it's worth. That land is always going to have value. I would suggest that if we finally found a tool that forced their hand and forced them to listen to us, we can use that to force it into a land swap. One serious problem that our nation faces is our national debt, and this is one issue here where if you vote for this bill, you are voting to increase our national debt. You are voting to increase that burden on our children and grandchildren, and that's not something I'm willing to do. The federal government can't afford it. We can afford to sit on the land. We're not so desperate that $100 million is going to make or break us. Let's sit on it and wait till we can trade it for some land that actually has real value.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. As I read the bill, the only mineral rights that are being retained are those on the Jackson Lake parcel, which is probably mostly covered by Jackson Lake. The rest of these parcels, there's no mention of the mineral rights. So, while I agree with everything that's being said, I wouldn't want to get lost on a rail against the federal government, because we don't like what they've been doing and we don't like what they're continuing to do. But if in fact we could get some of the other public lands in the state of Wyoming that had some meaningful use in exchange for this, that wouldn't be a bad idea. But we have been offered $100 million that goes to the Permanent Rental Fund, Lands Funds, and I'm just kind of torn on this issue. I know we've worked real hard for a long time on this. I know our previous governor worked real hard on it and kind of called their hand on it and got what he wanted, but he said he's not going to be here and he's going to leave this to the man downstairs. I haven't heard what the man downstairs wants on this yet, but as it stands right now, I'm probably for the bill.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The man downstairs, his grandfather actually sat downstairs also. And his grandfather fought hard against the creation of Grand Teton National Park. And in later years, he stated it was the worst mistake he made, because Grand Teton National Park has turned into one of the jewels of this state and has turned tourism into one of the number two industry in this state. We're number two. We bring a lot of money into this state through our tourism. People coming to Grand Teton, coming to my town, coming to Yellowstone. This is a jewel of this nation, not only of this state. And we have to remember sometimes that we are a nation. This is not only our park, it is all our park of everyone in this nation. We have negotiated for years over this. My own father negotiated back in the 80s and was unsuccessful. In exchange, just isn't going to happen. It's a complicated issue. Why? But it's not going to happen. To get to this point was amazing, that they're willing to actually pay the money that would go toward the education of our children. That's the purpose of these lands, by the way. That's why the federal government set aside these lands. When we came into the union, the Fed set aside, when they granted admission into the union, they set aside these lands, and they said, these are your lands that will be used for the education of your children. Right now, we earn $2,000 a year, $2,000 for the education of our children. Here they're offering us $107 million. As to the no net gain, this land is already within the exterior boundaries of the park. The one parcel, if you want to know where it sits, if you're ever driving and you just go north of Moose and you're heading and you're looking out at the Tetons and you want to pull over and take a real nice picture of the Tetons, you're actually on state land. That whole parcel up there on Antelope Flats is a state parcel. Sits right smack dab in one of the most beautiful places in this state. The other parcel sits out by Kelly a little bit, and it's a beautiful parcel. The Jackson Lake one is actually my favorite because it is all underwater. I guess we could do offshore drilling in the middle of Jackson Lake. But again, it's a jewel of our state, and I don't think we should be diminishing that. I would urge you to vote for this bill. It benefits our number two industry, tourism. It also benefits our children by increasing the funds for education, and I would urge you to vote aye.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Madam Chairman, I would have to comment about the tourism. Two cases, one on Jackson Lake. At one time, there were whatever they're called, ice planes or whatever, allowed to be used on that lake. And the Park Service took that away without good reason, not a good EIS to determine whether they should or shouldn't be done, but more of an arbitrary decision. You know, you're supposed to do an environmental impact statement and make an informed decision based on facts. Didn't happen on that one. And then we've been going for 15 years.
Madam Chairman, I'm going to call point of order. It's not germane to the bill, the snowplane issue.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. Chairman Childers, if you could confine your comments to the bill. Thank you.
The point of order, Madam, is that the subject was brought up about tourism, and I was basically countering that point that the benefits of this is part of it is for tourism. So I don't think the point of order was in order. I think I should have been able to comment on that. And further comments on the snowmobile issue. While it's in a different park, it is part of it because it's tourism. Just as the previous speaker was talking about tourism, I'm confining my comments to tourism. And arbitrary decisions by the federal agency as well as the Secretary of Interior to basically change after decisions have already been made. And it's confining to tourism, that tourism was being brought up as to why this should be sold. Now I'm on and against.
Mr. Majority Whip.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a question that has to do with, has there been any investigation to see what the potential for coal is underneath this property? The Jackson coal field has 700 square miles with 6.34 billion tons of coal. So, you know, there's quite a bit of mineral resources in that area that the state might want to hang on to.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I sat on the Ag Committee and listened to the testimony, and I guess I just wanted to present a business perspective on what we heard. I can appreciate the argument as to whether land is going to hold its value better than our green dollars will. But we're still paying for the schooling of our children with these dollars. I thought it was $1,500 a year, but maybe it is $2,000 a year that they get out of it. The money won't be blown in a month. It'll go into a trust fund. The present interest was 4.2%. They came up with $430,000 a year. I came up with $450,000 a year, closer to $450,000 a year. Anyway, quite a bit of money just on the interest. We'd have that money every year. I do know that the dollar would deflate and it'd be worth less. Anyway, the way we're going now, it'll be worth less. And the testimony of a judge that was there said that the trades that they've tried to negotiate with the federal government has usually been just useless land that has no minerals under it that they know. They're not willing to part with valuable cold land and whatnot. As far as the minerals go on the land, there wasn't much discussion in reference to what the previous speaker said, and other than under Jackson Lake, which you can't get to. But I'm in favor of this just simply because of the high volume of money that it would produce. We've had 20 years of argument over it, and another 5 years we lose $400,000 a year. It just seems like we need to look at the highest and best use for the land. Thank you.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Let's get back to perspective. These parcels are within the park, so it doesn't matter what's underneath the land or not. You're not going to, no matter who you are, you're not going to develop those, whether they could be gravel. The former chairman said, well, there's coal. Well, maybe there is, but it's within the park. Nobody's going to develop that land within the park for a coal mine or whatever. I can imagine the environmentalists coming along and saying, absolutely not. They'd tie you up for eons. So it doesn't matter whether there's coal there or not. It's land that was that when the park was formed, it's lands that were there. They were state lands. It's our right to try and maximize the greatest use for those lands. And right now, the greatest use is to put that into a trust fund it's for the children. It's for education. It's for education. And that $100 million will be in that trust fund for eons, and you will be able to use the interest for education. Right now, we get $2,000 for grazing. $2,000 doesn't make a lot of difference to anybody. But $100 million certainly will when you put it into the trust fund. This is something that has been negotiated, as you've heard, and if you read the packet that was handed out, it's been worked on for eons. And finally, the federal government blinked. And when they blink, we ought to take advantage. Like it or not, I don't like the federal government either. Most of the time, I don't trust them. But if they're going to give us $100 million for land that we can't use, then we ought to take it.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On and against the bill, I think that we've spent a lot of years, and the statement was just made that the federal government blinked. I think that it is a poor negotiating strategy to say to the very first real offer we've ever gotten in all those years, okay, fine, we'll take it. I think that we can use that a lot better if we stick to our guns. We understand that those lands are incredibly valuable. And here we have an opportunity to trade that land for the mineral royalties and the rights that we have all over this state that are currently in federal government's hands. I'd much rather have $107 million worth of our Wyoming mineral resources that are going to keep providing for our schools and our children for many generations in the future than to take the first cash offer that we get from the federal government.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I can assure you this was not the first cash offer. The first cash offer I found was $8 million. This has been negotiated for years. We have had many offers. We have actually had land exchange offers, but they've been so poor that we haven't accepted them because our primary responsibility is our fiduciary responsibility to the school trust. And I'm with you. I mean, I cannot disagree about the federal government mismanaging money, mismanaging issues, but we can either stand on principle or we can meet our fiduciary responsibility to the students of our state and the fiduciary responsibility to this trust by accepting this offer. Now, it was suggested that the offer was not a lot of money. The interest alone was actually the income estimate was $4.5 million a year. So it wasn't $450,000, it was $4.5 million. $4.5 million a year pays for one out of every 400 days of education. That's a lot. That's just the income from the investment. Pays one out of every 400 days of education. It pays almost 0.25% of our annual education budget. Any of you who do budgets for anything know that 0.25% is a significant amount of money. It's a significant income. Our current income pays for 4.5 seconds a year of education. Just to confirm, the mineral rights that we're talking about is only the parcel that is underneath Jackson Lake. So I know we're improving all of our mining techniques, but I submit to you it will be many years before we have the capability to mine under Jackson Lake. I encourage your favorable vote.
Chairman Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Almost question is right. Look, this is the same. This is exactly the same as putting $105 million in the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. How do I get there? Article 7, Section 1 of the Constitution says the legislature shall provide for the establishment and maintenance of a complete and uniform system of public instruction. Blah, blah, blah. Okay? So the school trust lands generate income that is used to support the public schools. To the extent that that income comes up short of what's required to meet that constitutional mandate, we make up the balance out of the general fund. And so $100 million in the permanent mineral trust fund, if you take the round number of 5% takeout, is $5 million a year. Now you can slice it one way or you can slice it another way, but that is $5 million a year that this would generate for the support of the schools that we don't have to make up out of the legislature because the state lands have never generated sufficient money to provide the educational system that's required by the Constitution. This thing is virtually a dead asset to us. It earns $2,000 a year and will never get any more. I can just guarantee you, inside that park, you are not going to build casinos, build big hotels, put up drilling rigs and start drilling or strip mining or anything like that. It just isn't going to happen. And because it isn't going to happen, we really don't have any leverage. And it makes good sense to do something with it. We've tried to trade for years to no avail, and they've offered property. In their mind, it was a fair trade. In our mind, it wasn't. We've never been able to strike a deal. Frankly, in my mind, they've offered us junk. but they see it a different way. And this is really the first time that they've ever offered any real significant money for this. And don't think of it as $105 million. Just think of it as it's $5 million a year. That's what we can make in perpetuity on this. That's about the takeout that we use on our other stuff. You can shade that a little bit one way or the other. But so they're not offering us $100 million. They're offering us $5 million a year in perpetuity. And that 5% takeout, if the money's managed right, should increase with inflation over time, because we have a whole management scheme that tries to inflation-proof those funds. As to the split mineral rights, I don't want to give you a whole law school lecture here, but remember, the reason that the feds own mineral rights under land in Wyoming is because Theodore Roosevelt decided that's the only way we were going to get the West settled. If the government had to hold out and couldn't allow homesteading or allow fee title of land to go until the government determined whether the minerals under it were worth anything or not, we were never going to get the West settled. And Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, is the one who broke the logjam and said, here's what we'll do. We'll have a split estate, we'll keep the minerals, and we'll get the West settled. And that's why it's there. And it was a good deal when it's done. When it was done, and it wasn't just done just to needle us. There was a really good reason for doing it. So just think about $2,000 a year versus $5 million a year. That is what it's all about, and I would urge you to support this, and let's do it.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I will be brief. I completely understand all of the arguments against this. I have talked it over with the good peoples that have brought this to me, and they finally got me convinced. But one of the main points that convinced me was in this handout that you got from the good representative from Teton County, the agreement. If you look at page 4 of 10 and look down at paragraph 4, and I'm going to read it to you. As long as the department acquires the parcels by the respective deadline set forth above, the department will hold a binding option to purchase the remainder of the parcels. So if they keep doing everything that they say they're going to do, they can keep purchasing the parcels in each order, in the correct order. But if they fail to do that, then we can terminate this agreement. We've got an out. And so that's the main thing. If the federal government does what they usually do, what they probably will do, we're just good. We're set. We're out. So on and for the bill.
Representative Petroff.
The one question I failed to answer that someone asked was whether or not the man downstairs approves of the bill, and he is a strong supporter and sent a representative to the committee to testify to that.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Semlich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 156 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 156 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 255. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 255, introduced by Representative Patton, an act relating to taxation and revenue, veterans tax exemption. This bill was sent to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson, sign Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 255 do pass. There are no amendments, and the representative from House District 29 will explain the bill.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We'll make this one a little quicker than the last. First, the question that might come to your mind is why this bill is being introduced, and I'll answer that in just a moment. But what does it do? It provides that a tax exemption that is applied and is in order by a veteran that is qualified may be renewed year after year, in by means other than going into the courthouse, signing the affidavit. Once that the property has been approved and the qualifications are there, they may be met by simply picking up the phone and calling the assessor's office, by telecommunication or other communications, as you see on line 15, 16, page 1, and it may be then confirmed that that he is still alive and continues to meet the requirements set forth in this section and the ownership of the land. With that, if there are any questions, I'm sure that the chairman of the Corporations Committee would be willing to answer.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I certainly stand in support of this. Ladies and gentlemen, what we find here is cutting down a lot of paperwork because putting on my hat now as commander of the Veterans of Foreign Wars over in the Bridger Valley, people will file these documents, and it takes a bit of doing to fill all of this stuff out. You have to provide supporting documentation when you file this with the county courthouse and then go forward instead of every year having to do this. If there's verification of it, and what we want to see is that there's verification either in person saying, hey, I'm still alive and well, my exemption is here, let me sign the sheet. That's kind of what they're doing. And those veterans that are completely disabled or in the nursing homes type stuff, we put provision in here also for telephone. So I unquestionably request the body to support this.
Further discussion on the bill? Representative Patton.
Just lastly, I said I'd explain why. The why is that it hasn't been uniformly assessed across the state or handled across the state in that fashion. Some county assessors have, in fact, been doing it just exactly as we propose. Others have not. So we're trying to make it uniform, trying to make it a little easier for them to have the qualifications met.
Further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 255 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 255 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 242. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 242, introduced by Representative Illaway, an act relating to insurance supply, surplus lines. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 242 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments. And Madam Chairman, I would ask for the call for the question on the Standing Committee amendment.
Question having been called. All of those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Last year, a particular bill, and I'm going to have to use its name so that you'll know, it was the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, and part of that was the Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Reform Act, and that was passed earlier this year by Congress. And in every state legislature will be faced in its next session, and that's why we're here, with enacting legislation to reform its surplus lines code to meet the requirements of the Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Reform Act, which becomes effective on July 21st, 2011. If such amendments are not made, surplus lines brokers, companies, and insureds will be faced on July 21st, 2011 with state laws that, while preempted by the bill, are inconsistent, if not in conflict, with the various provisions of the Act. This could result in confusion on the part of brokers and regulators over which regulatory requirements to apply, could affect market disruption for the insured as surplus lines producers and companies try to sort out competing regulatory requirements, delaying the consummation of insurance transactions for needed insurance, and even possible double taxation on surplus lines premiums between the states. So with your permission, I'm going to go through the act, and we'll do it, we'll start on page 1, which is a new section of the surplus lines law granting the commissioner general authority to enter a multi-state agreement or compact to carry out the purpose of the federal act. On page 2, the department believes there are 4 new definitions that are necessary to implement the minimum requirements of the act that are being inserted into the current definition section of the law. Because the current section has only 3 definitions, the new terms are inserted alphabetically and the section is renumbered rather than adding the terms to the end of the statute as they generally are. We talk about admitted insurer, and that's a uniform term used in the same manner as authorized insurer in other parts of the insurance code. Home state is the definition taken from the federal act and is critical to implement the new law because only the home state may regulate the non-admitted market and only the home state may collect premium taxes on surplus lines insurance regardless of the location of the property risk. If we continue on page 3, home state is either where the insured maintains its principal place of business, or if there is no insurance risk in the state that is the principal place of business, then the state where the greatest share of insurance risk is located is termed home state. Non-admitted insurance is a uniform term used in the same manner as unauthorized insurance in other parts of the code. Reciprocal state. Under the Federal Act, the definition required to share premium tax revenues that will be collected, reported, and dispersed through a national clearinghouse. Wyoming reaped about $2 million plus last year from these surplus lines, and this is why we want to continue doing what we've been doing. Page 5 enacts the federal preemption, recognizing that only the home state of the insured may require a surplus lines broker's license. Page 5 through page 7 are new sections which replace current law on how a broker collects premiums on surplus lines insurance and how the broker will collect and pay premium taxes to the home state for an insured having non-admitted insurance risks in more than one state. Page 5 continues. It authorizes the payment of all premium taxes and all gross premiums to a Wyoming surplus line broker when Wyoming is the home state. Wyoming will continue to collect a 3% tax on non-admitted insurance premiums associated with a Wyoming insurance risk. Half of page 6 sets forth the payment of premium tax where there is an allocation of taxes between Wyoming and another state. We continue on page 6. There's the return of premium to the policyholder upon early termination, an annual payment and reporting of the taxes due. Page 7 is an assessment of tax based on portion of the insured's risk located in Wyoming when Wyoming is not the home state. And the bottom of page 7 authorizes the commissioner to participate in a reciprocal accounting system to properly collect and distribute the premium taxes in the not admitted market. I'll stand for questions.
There discussion on the bill. Are you ready for the question on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 242 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 242 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 214. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 214, introduced by Representative Buchanan, an act relating to education, Hathaway Scholarship, college attendance. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended a due pass with amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Burkhart, Connolly, Croker, Madden, Teeters, no, Freeman, Crone, absent, Laux, signed, Representative Teeters, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Teeters?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 214 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. To explain the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment, we're going to have the good speaker present his bill.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll explain the Standing Committee Amendment in conjunction with the bill, and then we can vote on both in succession. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring before you House Bill 214, and basically the genesis of this bill was statistics given to us by our state's only four-year university. We're in for the school year 2009-2010. 58% of those Hathaway Opportunity Scholars lost their scholarship after the first year. And this is something I've been grappling with for some time. It goes right along kind of with our discussions on education improvement, right along the lines of kids that need remedial training. But this bill is aimed at perhaps stemming the number of the alarming number of kids that are losing their scholarships at the state's only four-year university. I would also mention that the numbers for the performance level scholarship aren't that stellar either. But I wanted to kind of take some baby steps with this bill and deal only with the opportunity scholarship. So as you look through the bill, you'll see basically what it does is says, if you are one of those kids who qualifies for the Opportunity Scholarship, we're going to ask that you start out at the community college level, and basically we want you to complete successfully 30 semester hours at the community college before you can move on to the four-year university. And there's a provision in the bill on page 3 that talks about kids that are already in the system at the four-year university who fail to meet the GPA requirements for the scholarship. They're not going to have to drop down from the four-year university to the community college, because that's kind of a logistical issue. But really, this bill goes towards looking towards the future and loading the pipeline with kids that are eligible for the Opportunity Scholarship and then are able to be successful at the Wyoming Community College level before continuing on to the university. And so that's basically the bill. The Standing Committee Amendment, as you can read, talks about adding reporting requirements. And basically, as you can see there, they're going to the Department of Education is going to include in their annual report an analysis of the effects of the provisions of this bill regarding retention and the persistence rates of the program recipients, and then they're going to also provide in the report recommendations regarding legislation to further the purposes of increasing retention and persistence rate for the Hathaway Scholarship participants. I felt that was a good idea, and I would encourage passage of the Standing Committee Amendment at this time.
We are on Standing Committee Amendment number 1. Are you ready for the question on Standing Committee Amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Question for the sponsor. Do you have numbers on how many opportunities graduates go to the University of Wyoming versus go to the universities? We kind of thought when we did this that most of those people would be going to the community colleges instead of the university.
Representative Blickrey.
Madam Chairman, and my question goes along the same lines, which is, has there also been discussions then about helping to fund the community colleges in order to be able to teach these classes? Because I do know that some of them have almost had to turn away people because they haven't had enough instruction. instructors. Thank you.
Further discussion? Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First of all, the ratio of student to teacher per pupil ratio is much, much better at the community college. That's the first thing. So students can get better attention. If they're struggling, if they need help, the ratios are better. Second main driving factor for why the committee supported the bill, I believe, is cost. It costs approximately twice as much to educate a student out of the state coffers at the university level as it does at the community college. So with those two factors in place, I think we're going to try this, and that's why we added the Section 3 where we can come back and look at the analysis as to what the success rate was and then compare it back. But, you know, the remedial courses that are offered at the community colleges are necessary for a lot of people that are in that cohort. Currently, I know LCCC is doing a lot of the remediation work for the university anyway. It's going to save the taxpayers money. Just makes a whole lot more sense to get those kids directed to the community college to start off the bat. We don't have, I don't have that data right now. We can get the data that indicates how many students with the Opportunity Scholarship are tracking currently into the community college system versus the university. But we'll see if we can find that and bring it up for second reading.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I have a question for the sponsor that if they're at the university and they've lost their Opportunity Scholarship, is it likely that they're probably already on academic probation? That I'm not real sure that if a parent is going to look at the $800 as a real, I guess, incentive to have their child move to a community college. I know my daughter struggled her freshman year in college, and she actually lost her Hathaway and has regained it. Now she's at 3.5 there in her senior year. Maybe some of you met her this past Sunday or Saturday when we were over there. But you know, I do have some concerns there that you know, we're maybe incentivizing parents to move their children to community colleges rather than have them, you know, stick it out there at the university, buckle down, regain their scholarship like my daughter did, be successful at the university. You know, I think if they go back to community colleges, they may not return back to the university. So, well, that's my concern.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. When I look at this bill and when I first saw it, I'm thinking, you know, this is a great idea. And I'm a very strong advocate for community colleges. In fact, I think that most kids should go to community colleges before they go to the University of Wyoming. But the more I thought about this, I think that there is a there's two reasons why I stand up and oppose this bill. First is I think that it's the kid's choice. Not only is there academic concerns when somebody chooses a college, but there's also social family concerns what they have, so that they should have the opportunity to decide where they're going. And the second thing that it is I wouldn't have qualified for the Hathaway. And so that gives you kind of an idea of my freshman and sophomore years in high school. But if you look at the balance of what I did, I was ready for a college if I chose to do that. I went to a community college, and that was the best thing that I've ever done in my life. And I think that ultimately it is the child and his parents' choice to where that they go. If they, for lack of a better way of saying it, and I think this is the best way of saying it, if they screw up and they lose their Hathaway scholarship, then they have to face those consequences. So I offer those thoughts for you to consider.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Folks, thank you for the good discussion on this, and we had a similar kind of discussion in committee where I voted in favor of the bill and have been thinking a lot about it since then. and honestly was going to stand at the podium until a couple of minutes ago and ask you to vote no. But it occurred to me that I think that we have a fix that's possible. There's at least two competing interests going on that we need to think about. One is that we know that kids at the university are at this level are losing their Hathaways at a significant percentage more than kids at this level at community colleges. So if we want success of kids in college, we know that they're doing better at the community college. We know that kids are not as well prepared going into the university, are not as ready to do university work. They're doing better at the community colleges. Basically, this bill says, let's try to assure their success by having them go to the community colleges for 2 semesters, 30 hours, not for a complete degree, but for 30 hours. That seems to be good. The other hand is individual choice and access to the university. There is nothing that says that these kids aren't qualified for going to the university. It's simply that they're not doing well with their Hathaway. On second thought, I thought about who are these kids that might not be doing so well. And those are kids that might be doing best at the university in programs that only the university has. And I'm thinking about the fine arts, and in all honesty, with my son. He would have been one of these kids at this level. He had already taken art classes at the community colleges. He needed, in order to keep him motivated, the quality of classes that he could only get at the university. So a third reading amendment that I'm considering is one that allows for students to, at this level, to petition the university for acceptance to keep their Hathaway at this level because of some particular special interest that's best met at the university and not one of our community colleges. So I'd encourage you to vote yes on this bill if you think that that amendment will help it. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just wanted to clarify and point out, I'm sure you all seen it in the bill, but I've had communication and pushback from my community college saying, what are we going to tell the students who are planning to transfer this fall to the University of Wyoming, and they don't have the 30 hours? It needs to be well understood. This does not apply to any holders of present opportunity scholarships. It doesn't even apply to those who are awarded a Hathaway scholarship this spring to attend in the fall of 2011. This would not take effect until the award of Hathaway scholarships to opportunity level winners in the 2012-2013 year. So if you're in anywhere enrolled today under a Hathaway opportunity level, this does not apply to you. Thank you.
Further discussion, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to try and address some of the questions to the good representative from House District 54, I apologize. I do not have the actual numbers of bodies that go to each of those institutions, but I will certainly find that out. And to the good representative from House District 41, who asked a little bit about kids that are already attending the four-year university. If you are already attending and you're on academic probation at that scholarship level, you will get to continue on under the parameters of that academic probation. Further, if you lose that scholarship level and you are required to drop down to a lower scholarship level, which the Hathaway scholarship program allows you to do, you are still allowed to stay at the four-year university, because I didn't think it was very logistical, feasibly, logistically speaking, to say, okay, pack up all of your things and go find one of the 7 community colleges to go to. I didn't want to do that. So I hope that addresses a couple of those issues that you had. And to the good representative from House District 60, you know, there's a fine line here. And I want to maintain that freedom of choice, but I would also submit to the body two things. One, we already dictate at the provisional scholarship level, which is one level lower than the opportunity, we already dictate that students have to go to community college. So I'm not breaking new ground in this regard. And in fact, the academic requirements for both of those scholarship levels, the provisional and the opportunity, are very similar. The only difference is if you can raise your ACT score up from a 17 to a 19, you can qualify for the opportunity scholarship. Otherwise, the GPA requirement of a 2.5 is the same, only a 2-point difference on the ACT. 2 points lower on the ACT, right now we say you start out at a community college and you demonstrate that you have the academic skills and the maturity to continue on at the four-year university. And the other thing I would add to that is not only are we already doing that, I think that's proper, and I think I can be corrected here, but I believe the historical discussion when the Hathaway was being developed actually included the idea that the opportunity scholarship would begin at the community college. Ultimately, it was decided that we wouldn't go that direction, but this certainly isn't a new idea. And if we're helping to pay the bill, I guess I feel like we should be able to dictate some of the terms. If you want to talk about choice, I'm all for choice, but I think we are allowed, paying the bill and investing a significant amount of money, to try to create a system that brings success for our students. A 58% dropout rate at the opportunity level is it's incredible to me, and I don't have all the answers, and this was just my attempt to perhaps try and stem the tide of kids that are losing those scholarships in the first year and tailoring it right off of the provisional scholarship. If somebody wants to go to the four-year school, they can do that. Perhaps that, you know, they can put a little bit of their own capital at risk if they want to try that. So
Chairman Brown.
Madam Chairman, here's what bothers me, and I'd welcome the speaker to disabuse me of this. We're such an impatient, impulsive bunch. And the freshmen that entered, the freshmen that are in the system right now, are the first crop of students that are a product of the full impact of the success curriculum. And the statistics that we're looking at in terms of dropouts and remediation were generated by students who did not fully fulfill the success curriculum. From here forward, starting with the ones that are in school this year as freshmen, the success curriculum is going to have an impact if it's going to have an impact. So we did the success curriculum because we felt we needed better performance from students in high school in order to qualify for the Hathaway. Then, before we even allowed that to work and before we even saw the results of it, we turn around and splinter off again in our kind of impatient, impulsive way we do, and said, well, they're not getting there. There's too much remediation and too much dropout. Well, we don't know what the remediation and the dropout rate is going to be from students who fully completed the success curriculum. And I just hate to start changing things. We're going to change so many things that we're never going to have a constant, and we're never going to know what works or what doesn't because we're going to have too many variables at play at once. And so that really creates a doubt in my mind about this. And the other thing that bothers me is I heard the statement made, but I'd sure like to hear the numbers on student-teacher ratios between the junior colleges and the university. I'm having a little bit of a hard time choking that one down as well. So if you have the same doubts as I do, you might not vote for this bill.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you. And I knew this would come down to it's all about the money. And those of you that have the university in your districts, I understand it's all about the money. But, you know, as a fiduciary, we need to all be, if we want to go down the road of it's all about the money, I can show you that it's costing approximately $8,000 more through the block grant process at the university to educate the same student as it is to run through the community college with the FTE program that we have there. So you can't win that argument either. But I do believe that the data that we're running on right now is complete data because it is the first cohort. If you want to look at the data from previous cohorts, I believe the data is worse. And I might be incorrect on that, but that's the information that I've been led to believe.
Mr. Speaker.
Just to the good representative from House District 14, I'd never try to abuse you or disabuse you, right? Very quite fond of you. The only thing I would say to your concerns, good representative, is that at the very least, the data I have, we're loaded up at least 3 years here with a success curriculum, if not four. And the numbers for 2006 and 2007 at the university, it was 55% in 06-07. It dropped to 48% 07 and 08, went to 51% in 08-09, and then shot up remarkably to 58% for 09 and 010. So I don't know exactly what that tells us, except if we're going to use the argument against this to say that as time goes by and more students experience the success curriculum, the rate of attrition will drop. Certainly the number rising 7% between 08 and 09 and 09 and 010 would blow that theory out of the water. So,
Chairman Brown.
Well, Madam Chairman, I have to defend myself a little bit gently. But I think it's as much about the money for those who have a junior college in their district as it is for those that have the four-year university in their district.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I am just having a little difficulty. Here we got two great programs. One, the community colleges, all seven of them. And then in addition to that, we have the Hathaway program. And they're going along fine, but we can't keep our hands off of them. We got to tinker with them some. And one of the things, how do you possibly be against this bill when they're both working with two fine programs? On page 3, line 21, the section G comes in following D, and so it's jumping back on the opportunity scholarship. And what's a little confusing the way the bill is presented in its printed form here is that the opportunity scholarship reinstatement is going to be at the community college. And then in B and D, they have an exception for that if the student was in the college, in the university, that then reinstatement would be possible as an opportunity scholarship as opposed to an honor scholarship. Have we really thought through all of the ramifications of that intermingling between the opportunity scholarship, forcing them to go to the community college, even though they might have been at the University of Wyoming?
Further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Teeter's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 214 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
House Bill 214 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I know we've got a couple big heavy-lifting bills coming up here. I'd like to, if we could, get through House Bill 197 or House Bill 209 today. That's the hope, and maybe the gentle prod.
Representative Freeman.
Privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
Up in the balcony to my left is Dr. Sandy Caldwell. She's the Associate Vice President of Western Wyoming Community College. She's here to watch us talk about sending kids to community colleges. Would you please welcome?
Welcome, Dr. Caldwell. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 22. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 22, introduced by the Transportation Committee, an act relating to fuel tax, phased-in fuel tax increase. This bill was sent to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Botten, Kennedy, Peterson, Vronish, Swanitzer, Dave, no, Bonner, McKim, Korberg. Signed, Representative Korberg, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Korberg?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 22 do pass, and I turn the explanation of this bill over to the good Vice Chairman of Transportation from House District number 19. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to bring House Bill 22 to the body this afternoon as phased-in fuel tax increase. This was an interim transportation committee bill. We heard a lot of testimony throughout the interim on this, the need for it from various sources. We had different organizations that came in and testified on behalf of it, and were in support of the bill. So I'd just like to indicate that's what's happened. Why is the bill being brought forward? We're looking for alternative stream of revenue to fix our roads. Our roads are one of the transportation corridors of the state, and of course we need that for commerce and economic well-being of this particular state. We had failure of a tolling road bill in the last legislative session, and as a result we looked at alternatives and thought the best way to proceed is this fuel tax program that we're offering here today. If you would look with me, if I direct your attention, it's well summed up in the fiscal note, which is at the end of the bill. It shows here the revenue increases that will take place. And if you look at fiscal year 2012, you can see there's an increase there. That's 3 cents. This bill proposes a 3 cent tax increase starting the 1st of July of 2011 to go forward with. And then you can see in another year, fiscal year, it's 3 more cents. And then it terminates with 4 cents in 2014 for a total of 10 cents throughout this time frame. Why is it in increments? There are numerous reasons for that. Number one, we knew that if we run it through increments, we could, if things went bad or things didn't work out with the constituents or whatever may happen here, we can have another legislative session, perhaps terminate this bill or modify it, whatever needed to be done, because this is not going to be an instant 10-cent increase. The second thing is that we were coming off of an economic recovery here in the state of Wyoming. We didn't want to put an undue burden on the people with 10 cents on gasoline. So we did an incremental type workup on this approach. Those were the two main reasons. I'm sure there are others. Members of the Transportation Committee may remember some of the other comments, but that's basically what drove it at this particular point in time. A couple of points on this bill here. It provides a steady stream of revenue. That was one avenue we looked at because the roads are constant maintenance type situation. And I'll address that in just a minute, how much that is that we need there being done. The next thing, one of the beauties of this particular stream of revenue, it is being paid for by the users. It's not levying a tax on somebody else, and we feel it takes pressure off the general fund because for highway improvements and road maintenance, we have relied very in large part on the general fund. But I don't want to stand here, and the intent of the bill is not that this bill is the answer, the panacea, if you would, to all road revenue needs. It's not. We'll still be coming to the general fund. But nevertheless, we'll do some diversification here, and we feel that that is a very positive thing to go forward to our Department of Transportation to work on various things. With the interstate systems we have in the state, of course, a lot of that is funded by federal dollars. Now, there's a problem with that, and we know what's happening. We had a one-time stimulus fund package that came out. That was a shot in the arm, very beneficial to the state. And as a result, the Wyoming Department of Transportation was able to reach up on the shelf, pull down a lot of the projects that they had in being, and make things happen because we were ready. It had a 90-day window on it where we had to act or we didn't receive the funding, but we did very well in that regard. But that stimulus funding is a one-time thing. So as a result, we are now facing the situation of what's next. Well, what's next? We anticipate there'll be diminished federal funds is coming, and I think we are very prudent in taking that course of action because the federal fund pool is going to dry up in that regard. So we have to backfill this the best we can. We'll still have some federal funds, but this is one thing that we're looking at here. YDOT submitted to us that the department needs, and these are some figures, and I just want to give you a couple of these to give you a sense of what we're looking at here. needs 134. $5 million. I want to say that again, $134.5 million on an annual basis to maintain the road system. That's a lot of money that we have out there, the needs for that. Now, that's just the YDOT aspect of this. One of the things that I thought was rather intriguing, like to share with the body, is that an asphalt road has a 20-year life. Concrete has a 30-year life. Concrete's more expensive, but in proportion, concrete, for the dollars that you're putting into it, you get a longer wear factor on it than you do the asphalt. And, of course, they look at those factors and evaluate it and make decisions on which way to go based upon traffic count studies, environmental factors, weather factors, and those kind of elements. It makes this determination what kind of surface we're going to use in. Now, I made two handouts here for us. And I'd like to focus your attention on this one, the counties. And when I say that, the chairman of the counties came in and talked to us about their needs for roads. And what I'm going to portray to you is we've got YDOT, you got counties, and what's happening here. Look at this sheet just a little bit. If we could focus on the bottom of it, you'll see that the counties have indicated, and you can look at your respective county, of course, here, and see the paved, the gravel, and the total roads there, and the needs that they have identified. And they went through the reasoning and the rationale for putting these figures on these sheets, which took quite a period of time. But nevertheless, you can see there's $241,285,000 here. Did the county wish we could give that money to them? Absolutely. Did we look at them kind of funny? Absolutely. And we know it's over a period of time, and they fully expect that. But what's really was an eye-opener for me, and I think the rest of the committee, look at the comments here on the left side, and you get an idea of what's going on in their lives here and in their worlds where you and I live also. Some of the cost factors are entered in there. What is costing them on paved, gravel, dirt, those kind of elements come into play. And I thought that was rather informative and added to this. So the counties are also out there, and of course there's numerous other collateral issues here on development that's taken place in the state that's put more of a burden upon their roads. But nevertheless, they provided that sheet. During the course of this study, we also had discussion about what's the kind of traffic we have on the interstates, what's causing this kind of stuff. Lots of figures and things were thrown around. We were provided with this sheet, which I thought was very informative. If you could direct your attention to this one. This is provided by an association that represents one of the largest travelers in terms of commercial freight on our highway system. Please look at Wyoming on the bottom. If you look at the annual registration and weight fees, you'll see $2,231 on the bottom. You'll find that we rank 11th in the nation at that particular point in time. The next thing over, of course, is the diesel fuel tax. It's 14 cents a gallon. You'll see that our ranking there is 47th. That's low. The next thing over is fuel tax gallons. Now, this is an assumption. If you look at the bottom qualifier, this is an 80,000-pound gross vehicle weight, five-axle semi that's running in the state, and they would consume 20,870 gallons. Is what this snapshot has shown us. At 14 cents there, you'll see there's $2,922. Now, continuing along there, total annual state highway user fees is 9,000, or you add those two columns together, the 2,000 and the 2,000 is $5,153. Then you see a constant that comes in here on every state, and that's federal type stuff, of $8,959. So we end up with a total per one of these vehicles at $14,112, 40th in the nation. That's where we're at. And the question came up, are we bearing a disproportionate share of this with the people that are perhaps using it more than they should be? That was an informative piece for us. But what it did show to us is that we need to look at the fuel tax increase just a little bit, because that column that shows we're 47th in the nation on diesel is low. So where we're at. So, ladies and gentlemen, what I'd like to do now is just turn to the bill. The bill has not changed. That bill is set in statute right now. We did not change the bill. The only thing that's changing in there is the tax rate. So the language is not changing at all. And if you focus on page 1, line 16, you'll see that that's exactly what we're doing here. If it's 14 cents, now you can see if we add the 3 cents, it gives it to 17. And then going flipping over to page 2, it gives the rest of this, and it gives the time period that this is going to be brought in a phased-in approach. And then you look here on line 9, this is how it's levied and collected here. Now, one thing I would like to point out, on the gasoline side of the fence, we have 1 cent that goes to the underground storage tank program. It has a rather different name, and I won't pronounce that, but nevertheless, that's what it's used for. Now, we go over to page 3. There's 3 entities that come in here. Just touch this real quick like. You have snowmobiles here, you have motorboats, and you have off-road vehicles. And they are handled a bit different. That's what it amounts to. Their tax money or credits that they receive go to state parks. And why is that? Snowmobiles don't travel on the roads. But the state parks maintain the roadways for the snowmobiles in their respective capacities. The same thing happens at boat docks. They do that. And then the final thing that you find on that situation is the off-road vehicles. They maintain trails. So that money goes right to the state parks for those 3 type of entities. The final piece of this, ladies and gentlemen, is taxation rate on diesel. It's found on page 5. You can see it's happening there also. It goes on line 21 from 17 cents up from 14 cents to 17 cents. And so on. That's what's being done throughout this bill. So the bill is not changing. Really, it's a policy consideration. What does the floor want to do? What other alternatives do we have? Where are we at? There are several given factors here. Number 1, roads are going to deteriorate. 2, we need to repair them. 3, we need money to do that. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, that's kind of the overview. I would ask the Transportation Committee if they have any thoughts or comments to please join in here. And I know that the good representative from the district sitting next to me would like to share some thoughts on this, House District 40. So I'll now yield the microphone.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, in one way or another, I guess I've been involved in this issue for 5 years. The first 4 years, we were working on the same issue. It wasn't quite as good a bill, I guess, as we have now, because we were going to do it all at once one time, and then we were going to do it twice, 2 times one time, and this is really truly a phase-in. but I guess the reason that I want to talk a little bit about it is that over this 5-year period, it seems like there are some issues that always seem to come up. And some of the issues are really kind of, I guess I would call them fallacies. and this is just looking at it from an economic standpoint. You can call it economic theory or call it anything you want, but it's kind of the economics of the fuel market. The first issue that I want to deal with is the thought that this tax will be shifted entirely to the pump. Or in other words, there's still people out there that think that if you add 3 cents on to the tax, that it will show up, you know, click, click, click on the gas pump the next morning. This is really an oversimplification. The market is much more complex than that. You know, nowadays we've got distributors, and we don't collect this fuel tax at the retail outlet in the first place. This is another thing that I found out some people are confused on. This is what we call, we collect this tax. It's a per gallon tax. We collect it, you know, at the rack, so to speak. So it's the distributors that pay the tax. So if you own a filling station, that gas comes out of this transport truck. The fuel tax is paid. They don't pay any of the tax, and life goes on, all right? Now, like we've got now, distributors work multi-state, all right? So a distributor that might work and have customers in Wyoming also has distributors, or I should say retailers, in State C, south of us. Or they might even have retailers in State N, to the east of us. All right? You get the idea? All right. Now, what is one of these jobbers, one of these distributors, going to do in pricing their product? First thing they do is, well, we got to pay the refiner, okay? The next thing they got to do is they got to pay their operational costs, delivery costs, transport costs, and so on. The other thing they have to do, they uniquely have to do, is they got to pay the state taxes. So they go to State C and they look up on the book what their tax is. They have to write them a check, and they go to State N or to Wyoming, whatever it is. And that's another cost, all right? Let's just call that aggregate taxes, okay? So you got your operational costs, your tax costs, and you got your cost to the refinery. Now, the thing is that you got to realize that these distributors add up those costs and they look at what margin they need. And believe me, they don't come up with a Wyoming price list and say, we're going to pass this all on to you because your fuel tax is way less than ours. You guys are charging a dime less, so we're going to give you a dime less at the rack or at the distributor. That is not the way it works. So the idea here is that all this is pooled together, and when they work on this cost, we, unbeknownst to us, are paying a part of State C's tax. And we're paying a little piece of State N's tax and, of course, ours. All right? So that's something it's important that you realize. Now, what kind of empirical proof does this can I give you to support this? And I think it was 1998 we raised the tax a nickel, I think it was. And by the way, in 1998, roughly speaking, fuel was $1 a gallon. All right, so in percentage terms, that was like a 15% or 16% tax on the product. All right. When this went through, and it went through in one chunk, there was no phase in, but all the people who are watching this at the time will verify that there is no effect at the pump. There was maybe a negligible effect, but there is an effect. I mean, it had to be passed on, but we're out, you know, somebody had to pick it up. Part of it was picked up in the margin. Part was picked up by retailers in State C, and State S, and all the rest of them around here, any place where they deal in a multi-state environment. I guess another myth is that lower taxes lead to lower prices at the pump. And the proof of the pudding I'd like to offer at this point is in your desk, where you'll see this pudding right here. It's color pictures of the trend lines over. You'll see the big side. The side that's big is the diesel, and then on the other side, which I hope I have here. Here it is. Where is it? Oh, yes, here it is. That's the gas one, and that's one that I had for before. And the reason I send this one out, this is the one that looks like this and has got my neat handwriting at the bottom. All right? Those are the taxes in all of these states that I've got listed here. All right? Now, I shouldn't have told you that. I should have just had you look at the diesel one. And should have asked you to tell me which of these states has the highest tax and which one has the lowest tax. You can't tell me, can you? You can once you look at the legend on top. If you look at the green line, that's us. I'm looking at the diesel one now. And the lower one, the other one is the gas, but it's got the prices on it. You can index it. You know it's somewhere between, 8 and 12 cents difference between our rate and everybody else's. But I defy you to tell me that green diesel line is the line that belongs to the state that has the lowest tax. In short, ladies and gentlemen, there's other things that determine market price in the real world. I'm not saying it's not an important sort of thing. I'm not saying it doesn't have anything to do with it, but there's certainly a lot of other things that has an impact on price. And you know, I got an anecdotal example where I live in Johnson County. We were known from historical periods when they first started selling fuel on as being the highest priced city to buy fuel. Guess what? Now we're the lowest. We're the lowest place. If you want to come to my hometown and buy fuel, you're going to be happy because it's the lowest price you'll ever find in this state. It wasn't because the DOT decided to take off our tax. It's just differences in competitive positions that's taken place the last 6 or 8 months. Okay. I think I've hammered that good enough. The next thing I want to talk about is equity. We have equity problems arising from using an inappropriate source of financing a public good that has easily attributable user benefits. Okay? In our case, it's been documented that 53% of all the fuel that's sold in Wyoming is bought by somebody that doesn't live in Wyoming. That means that 47% is bought by us. Okay? Now, any mechanism that we use to subsidize the upkeep of the and expansion of the road system is a direct subsidy to the 53% of the people who use our road and pay a reduced sales tax. I know if I was sitting up here and I could show you that 93% of the fuel tax was paid by out of state, or 93% of the fuel was bought by out of state people, and we only paid 7% of it, you'd probably say, oh, well, I guess I can vote for it then. And you probably would, because that's what it happens to be the tourism tax percentage for motels. You know, that passes, you know, every 4 years or whatever, they have to have a vote on that. That passes all the counties almost without fail, because they walk in and they say, well, let the other guy pay, and I could pay, I guess, the 7%. Okay. The other side issue in this regard is, what about when you travel out of state and as Wyoming citizens and you visit somebody in the Windy City and east of us or south of us, you know, you're paying their fuel tax. They don't give you a break just because they see a Wyoming license plate. They don't recall that when they came out here to visit our national park last summer that we didn't charge them and they want to just repay us. That doesn't happen. So we've got this kind of an equity problem, too. You're paying a higher fuel tax, whether you admit it or not. Take another simple example. This morning, I ran out of bananas, so I ate an orange this morning. And it occurred to me that, you know, it had a sticker from the westernmost state in the United States that raises oranges. Okay, and to get here, that orange had to go through that state, and then it had to go through the gambling state to get here. And while it was in the state it originated in, the fuel tax was 49 cents per gallon. And then it went to the next one, to the next gambling state, and the fuel tax in that state is 28.6 cents. Okay, then you go to the where the Salty Lake is. You go through that state. We're following the transport route here. That has a tax rate of 24.5 cents. Now, when we get to the neighborhood of my seatmate down there and enter Wyoming, that's when I start saving money on my orange because the tax is only 14 cents here, all right? So economically speaking, you all have to agree that those imputed fuel taxes of that little orange that I ate this morning was all in that orange somehow. We're not talking about an orange. We're talking about everything that comes into Wyoming that's imported. I don't know if I paid one penny less for that orange because I got a break on fuel taxes in Wyoming. Now, the other thing I want to emphasize, this is a user fee, folks, we're talking about. We have a simple question here of whether we want to pay as we go by the users with a user fee, or if we want to go down the same road we've gone down the last 4 or 5 years and strip out another $450 million, almost $500 million, away from our savings stream vis-a-vis the severance tax. And in my way of thinking, kind of rob future generations who would be beneficiaries by our saving that money instead of us selfishly wanting to save a few bucks on our fuel every year. And I just don't think that's the Wyoming way. It's not the Wyoming values, and I think that we can do better at that. In fact, a guy that's occupying an office elsewhere in this building, I heard him say in a speech a while back that we don't want to overgraze our grandchildren's pastures. And I think this is probably be something to think about in this regard. Another thing that's really important, folks, is that this is a way to incorporate a stable spending stream to local governments. I don't know how many of you realize this, but between 30-35% of the fuel taxes find their way back to each and every county in the way of aid to their roads and streets and highways. And what's happened to us in how far a dollar goes in the last 13 years has also happened to them. And I will say that there's absolutely no cheaper way for us to come up with money to help local governments than to impose this fuel tax. And here's why. I said a little bit ago, if there's any of this tax paid by buyers of fuel in this state, and there probably is, but if any of it's paid, 53% of it's paid by somebody else that doesn't live here. Okay? And when you look at the other 47%, you know, how much of that 47% do you suppose would be bought by automobiles, just people going to work in their car or their pickup? It's less than half of that 47%. The rest of it is bought by trucks. Now, this gets into another paradox here. This is a tax, ladies and gentlemen, that enjoys widespread support from a myriad of responsible organizations. And contrary to tolls, which hardly nobody supports, we have an association here that represents cities that's backing this very hard. We have another state association that represents counties that have gone on board saying they support it. Another association that has represents the trucking industry in this state who you would think maybe at the outset would say, we would like to have a break on our tax, but they'll come in to a committee meeting and say, you know, we know that good roads cost money, and bad roads cost us a lot of money in terms of wear and tear on our rolling stock. We also have an organization that represents most of the contractors in this state. They enthusiastically support it. We've got associations that represents engineers and architects, and they promote it as well, and they are in support of it. We got another organization that promotes coal in this state, coal production and mining. They've gone on board being solidly in favor of this, even though they use a lot of fuel on the roads. And then we have also the oil and gas representatives, organization that represents most of the oil and gas companies. They come in and support it very hard. I guess in closing, I hope you carefully examine the merits of this. You know, don't vote with your impulse. Let your heart do it, and I think we'll be okay. I guess the other thing I'd just like to leave you with is that let's just assume, I don't want you to put your head down on the desk or anything like that, because you might go to sleep. But let's just suppose we woke up and all the states surrounding Wyoming raised their tax on their home states by a nickel. All right? Maybe it's kind of an economics test here. What do you suppose would happen to the price of fuel in Wyoming if they all did that? Well, if you're up being honest about it and you understand anything of what I've said today, we're going to pay for it. We're going to pay for part of it. You know, when that goes into that price mix, part of the prices of that nickel gas is going to be ours. And the last thing I'll ask you is, what if we decide that this whole idea of a fuel tax is a lot of bunk, and we just abolish it, so we don't even have a 14 cent, we just go down to zero? You think we wake up tomorrow morning with 14 cents less fuel or less cost at the pump? Of course not. So anyway, I really respect your listening to me on this. Some of you may have made your mind up on the way or before you got here, but I'm hoping that at least this will inspire some debate, and maybe not. Thank you.
Chairman Illaway.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. And thank you to the Professor of Economics. And I really do mean it, and I don't mean it sarcastically. That gentleman does have a PhD in economics, and I do appreciate his efforts, except I'm against the bill. He did a great job of explaining it, but if you don't think you're eventually going to pay that tax, you will somewhere. You know, it really depends on what the competition does. If you've got retail stations all up and down the street, they're all going to be about the same. But the guy out somewhere else, he's going to be higher. Somebody else is going to be lower. I never did really totally figure out about pricing at the retail level. And maybe the professor did come along with how some of that does work. And it's confusing and it's complicated. And I remember several years ago, one of the chief executives of this state said, it would really be nice to figure out how it all worked and how it all fit together, because he got beat up continually about tax increases, fuel prices, and so forth. And it was quite a long process. One of the gentlemen talked about the need for counties to get taxes or fuel tax increase. Then let's give it directly to the counties for roads. I am so disappointed that the tolling study stopped. the tolling study would have exempted some Wyoming drivers, or all of Wyoming drivers, those folks that had to drive I-80. Everybody is going to get to pay this tax in the entire state and all of the people that come through, and if you don't think you're not going to get it, you've got another thought coming. I don't think we need to do a fuel tax increase. We continue, and I'm one of the ones that helped put together a bill for the Legislative Stabilization Reserve Account, and I'm proud of it. And we said we wanted to get at least 10% of the state's assessed valuation. And when we put that together, I think it was about $18 billion. And I think we've got about 1.5 in it now. We do not need a fuel tax increase. We need to start spending some of our money that we're getting. We have a savings problem because we think we need to keep socking it away. And that may be correct, and we need to keep putting some away. We do not need to put it all away. We need to spend some of the money that we are getting and not increase fuel taxes. People have said, well, we're in a recession. We don't need a fuel tax increase. Well, we're coming out of the recession. We still don't need a fuel tax increase. I don't care whether it's 3% every year or whatever it is. We need to be careful of what we're doing, but we need to go ahead and spend money and have YDOT spend it carefully on highways. If the counties in this and my home county here is having problems on county roads because of the oil play, then let's help those folks with money. Let's not start saying, well, we'll do the fuel tax and it'll siphon on down to the counties. You know that it gets siphoned off every place and the counties are the last to get it and they don't get very much. I think we need to give the counties some money and help them. But I'm on and against House Bill 22, and I'm not going to take any more time.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I, too, am on and against this bill, but I'm up here for a different reason, and that's just to make sure that you understand one point. During testimony on this bill, the good agency that receives the bulk of this funding and does work on our roads was specifically asked if passing this fuel tax would mean that they would no longer be coming to the legislature for additional money in the event that we had what I would call unanticipated revenue. And they were very forthright and upfront in saying no. They would still, in the event of unanticipated revenue realized on our part by the state, they would be coming to ask for additional funding. So I just wanted to make sure that the good body had clarification on that point. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be short and sweet. I've been on transportation. This will be my fifth year. The roads are deteriorating. We don't have a proper funding mechanism for them. This is a good way to do it, in my opinion. We phased it in over 3 years, and I don't know if I can say much more than the representative from Johnson County said, but the Big Sky State is 27 cents a gallon, 27.75 for diesel. The land of Mount Rushmore is 22 gasoline, 22 diesel. Land of the Huskers is 23.9, gasoline 23 for diesel. Land of the Broncos down south of us is 22. And the land of the Beehive State is 24.5. We haven't raised it since 1998. As was mentioned, a lot of associations are behind this. This will help our cities, towns, counties, on and for House Bill 22. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On and against House Bill 22. I'm just kind of a simple person. My neighbors are simple people, but we travel quite a bit. And I can tell you that I don't understand all of the economic mechanisms behind those things, but we always make sure to fill our tanks to the absolute fullest before we cross any state line, because the fuel costs anywhere else in the West are invariably higher, sometimes dramatically higher than they are right here at home. And my friends, my neighbors, are well aware that this state has done a pretty good job taking care of our fiscal house, and that as a result of that, we are in pretty good shape. And the very clear message that that they presented to me was that so long as there is that kind of financial stability and even, you know, enough excess that we can save the kind of savings that we have, that it would be irresponsible for us to raise taxes. And so for those reasons, my vote will be no. And I hope that yours will be as well. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Madden.
Very briefly, to the comments from the good legislator from District 42, I agree with him, and he agrees with me. He says we don't have to have a fuel tax, and of course that was my point. We don't need to have a fuel tax. We can go on and keep siphoning it off of the savings stream and do that. But there's reasons why. You can just fund things, or you can fund things the right way. And you also found in your basket here a thing from an association that represents the taxpayers in Wyoming. And if you go right down the line, everything they're saying has, economic soundness to it. It's equitable because it's user-based. There's no equity in saying that a future generation should be paying for this, unless you just say, well, we don't want to leave the future generation too well off. We just want to leave them a little bit. The balance, if we go ahead and fund roads like we can in the past, we're going back to the old one-legged stool. Let big energy pay for this too. We can do it, and I know we can. But I'm just asking you to do some soul searching and ask what is the best thing for us, and what's the best way to treat our neighbors. Thank you.
Representative Roscoe.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just think that we should really pay as we go. That's a good fiscally responsible way to go. I think most of us try to do that. Doesn't make any sense to me to dip into savings money that we have put aside that earns us money to pay for something that's not paying for itself. That's mineral money, and some of that mineral money belongs to our future generations. It's a finite resource that we're using up, and it'd be pretty embarrassing to, at the end of our mineral boom, to not have anything to show for it. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I wasn't going to get up to speak on this because I think everybody but the newer members of this body know that I support this because I think it's a user fee. And I think user fees are the best way that we should finance things like our highways. In committee, I happen to be in committee waiting to present another bill. There were some numbers, and I don't have those numbers, that somebody brought up about what it would cost a family that drove 20,000 miles a year. I was surprised at what a little amount of money that was, this fuel tax increase. It's too bad we don't know that. But we tend to want to put these things off and put these things off. And then the next thing we're going to be up here doing then is saying, okay, if and when we have the downturn, and we always have a downturn, Are we going to raise severance taxes? Seems to be counterproductive to me. We're taxing the people that have been paying the bill all this time. The was alluded to in Tax 2000, our study, our own study, so I can use that term here. We need more legs on the stool that we're sitting on because we're going to fall over. We're not propped up good enough the way what we're doing. And this is another reason that I look at user fees. We do user fees to help fund our parks. We do user fees to help fund of many other things. A lot of our businesses, Public Service Commission is funded by the utilities that it governs. They're the ones that pay that, not we as the individual citizens. We probably pay it through our bills because it's part of that overhead that I talked about earlier on some other bills. But I just like the body to think about that. It's a user fee. We use the highways. The vast majority of the miles are put on in Wyoming are put on by out-of-state vehicles that come here either through the tourists or hauling materials through our state or to our state. And as the good economist pointed out, we're not getting any break from on the sale price for those things on and for the bill.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just briefly, the recovery is still fragile. I don't want to add to any new taxes until there's more surety about getting unemployment under control, getting people earning again, and getting our economy going again. In my agricultural area, an additional tax would add to the cost of production, and margins are already narrow in that field. So for these reasons, I cannot support an increase in the gas tax. Thank you.
Is there further discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Korberg's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 22 do pass, please say aye. Those opposed?
No.
House Bill 22, having failed a voice vote, a standing division vote is required. All those in favor, please stand. Those opposed? Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbudo.
No.
Berger.
Aye.
Blake.
Aye.
Flickery.
No.
Bonner.
No.
Botten.
Aye.
Brechtel.
No.
Brown.
Aye.
Burkhart.
No.
Bird.
No.
Campbell.
No.
Kennedy. Childers.
No.
Connolly.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Davison.
No.
Davison.
No.
Edmonds.
No.
Eklund.
No.
Esquivel.
Aye.
Freeman.
No.
Gay.
No.
Gingery.
No.
Goggles.
No.
Greer.
No.
Green.
No.
Harshman.
No.
Harvey.
No.
Hunt.
No.
Illaway.
No.
Yagi. Kasparic.
No.
Croker.
No.
Crone.
No.
Lockhart.
No.
Laux.
No.
Lubno.
No.
Madden.
Aye.
Madden.
Aye.
McKim.
No.
McComey.
No.
Miller.
No.
Moniz.
No.
Nicholas.
No.
Patton.
Aye.
Peasley.
No.
Pedersen.
No.
Peterson.
Aye.
Petroff.
Aye.
Korberg.
No.
Roscoe.
Aye.
Simlek.
Aye.
Shepperson.
No.
Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
No.
Teeters.
No.
Throne.
No.
Braunisch.
No.
Wallace.
No.
Swanitzer Dan.
No.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
No.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Are there any changes? The vote is closed. 13 ayes, 47 noes.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Bill 22, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First, an announcement. Remember, Friday is the last day for bills to be reported out of committee in the House of Origin. With that, Madam Chair, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 93, recommended do pass. House Bill 131, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 187, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Representative Lubno moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. House Bill 189, amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 179, recommended, do pass. House Bill 156, recommended, do pass. House Bill 255, recommended, do pass. House Bill 242, amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 214, amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 22, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Signed, Representative Kraft, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
Representative Kraft.
I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 188. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 91, Wildlife Livestock Disease Research Partnership Funding. Ayes 28, noes 2, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 189. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 93, Dietetics Licensure. Ayes 22, noes 8, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 190. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicate, Senate File 106, School Finance Local Resources, I-17, Nose 13, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 191. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated, Senate File 117, Wyoming Reclamation and Restoration Center. Ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 192. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated, Senate File 119, Real Estate Brokers and Salesmen Revisions 2. Ayes 28, noes 2, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 193. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated, Senate File 85, Game and Fish Violations Penalties. Ayes 21, noes 9, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 203, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Beasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 216, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brown, Green, Crone, Peasley, Throne. No, Brechtel, Kennedy, Nicholas. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 249, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. No, Brechtel. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 254, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Barbudo, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Beasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 172, respectfully reports same back to the House that it with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Edmonds, Escobel, Harshman, Pedersen, Stewart, Wallace. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 215, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Edmonds, Escobel, Harshman, Pedersen, Stewart, Wallace. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number six, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom must we file Senate File 27 engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Shepperson, No, Yagi. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number eight, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom is referred House Bill 90, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Bonner, Botten, Kennedy, McKim, Peterson, Korberg, Vronish, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Korberg, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number eight, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom is referred House Bill 194, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Bonner, Botten, Kennedy, Peterson, Korberg, Vronish, Zwanitzer, Dave, No, McKim. Signed, Representative Korberg, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number nine, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 260, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. No, Byrd, Roscoe, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred Senate File 74, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan, Swanitzer, Dave. Excused, Byrd, Roscoe. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred Senate File 75, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan, Swanitzer, Dave. Excused, Byrd, Roscoe. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred Senate File 76, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan, Swanitzer, Dave. Excused, Byrd. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred Senate File 92 engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Byrd, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
Re-referrals, Chairman Illoway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to re-refer House Bill 257 from your committee number 7, Corporations, to your committee number 1, Judiciary.
It's been moved for a re-referral of House Bill 257 from committee number 7 to committee number 1, Judiciary. Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Continued with your committee announcement.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow at noon recess in House 18. We'll take up House Bill 231, Postdated Checks, House Bill 238, Tattoo Studios, Blood Donation Certification, Senate File 4, Elections, Military, and Overseas Voters, and Senate File 23, Engrossed, Mail Ballot Elections, and this is a revised notice.
Chairman Childers.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet in 10 minutes in room 302 to continue working House Bill 191, Wind Power Taxation, and then do House Bill 200, Property Tax Exemption Improvement and Service Districts, and House Joint Resolution 7, Distribution of Excess Funds.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet immediately upon adjournment in H-10 for consideration of the following bills. House Bill 225, Charter School Appeal Process 2, House Bill 241, School District Assessments, House Bill 264, Hathaway Scholarship School Notification, and House Bill 266, Student Assessment Body of Evidence.
Chairman Simlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet Thursday, February 3rd, 8 a.m., room H11, to hear House Bill 163, Water Produced from Geological Sequestration, House Bill 171, Corner Crossings at Intersecting Public and Private Lands, House Bill 222, Recreational Consideration of Public Lands Exchanges, and House Bill 226, Raw Agriculture Commodity Inspections Exemptions. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Corberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February 3rd, 15 minutes after adjournment in room H-17 to hear House Bill 207, Protection of Activities in Private Vehicles, House Bill 208, Off-Road Vehicle Registration Exemption, House Bill 246, National Guard Disposal of Land, House Bill 237, National Guard Educational Assistance, and House Bill 248, Unlawful Protesting at a Funeral - Amendments.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Speaker, your Judiciary Committee number 1 will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February 3rd at 6:59 a.m. to consider the following bills. House Bill 218, Civil Recovery for Criminal Act Limitation. House Bill 213, Medical Liability and Non-Economic Damages. House Bill 256, Wyoming Safe Home Acts 2. And House Bill 265, Name Changes Sealed.
Berman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Your Appropriations Committee, too, will meet upon adjournment to sign off on the budget. And we will meet in the morning at 8 a.m. for any re-referred bills. Thank you.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet in 15 minutes in room H17 to hear the following bills. House Bill 232, Workers' Compensation Impairment Ratings. House Bill 252, Review of State Executive Department Positions. House Bill 253, Wyoming Nurse Practice Act Amendments. House Bill 239, Child Caring Facilities Certification.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And now we have the good representatives Blake and Barbudo. The Cowboys take on the BYU Cougars tonight in Laramie. So all those in the gallery as well as those on the floor, we got a special treat, the accordion. That was the polka version of Cowboy Joe. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A few statistics just to end the day. There are 124 House bills still in committee. There are 32 House bills on general file. I expect another 22 bills out of committee by the end of the week, leaving 54 bills. There's 3 days of general file to go. We're averaging 10 bills per day. You can do the math. My intention is to go a little longer on Thursday. Hopefully, we can get out a little early on Friday if possible. It just depends on how many words we have. With that, Mr. Speaker, general file for tomorrow, February 3rd, 2011, the first 10 bills, House Bill 39, House Bill 197, House Bill 209, House Bill 161, House Bill 223, House Bill 213, House Bill 217, House Bill 193, House Bill 227, House Bill 216, and the other bills that are on the list. With that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 9:30 tomorrow morning, February 3rd, 2011.
Did you say 9:30?
9:30.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House is adjourned until Thursday, February 3rd, 2011 at 9:30 a.m. 9:30.